So good morning. It's 7, what is it, 7:39 a.m. on the 27th of March, 2013. Yeah, 7:39. I'm out early today. I got the wind behind me. No, that's not actually. It's the figurative wind, not the literal wind. I didn't seem to be any wind this morning. 16 and a half minutes for the first mile. Gotta love that. Gotta love that. So yeah, I've had some epiphanies about Greedock the Splithead. It has to do with writing about aliens. And one of the realities of writing about aliens is that you can't. You can write part of them as alien, but you can't write about total alien. Or you can, but it's very difficult to come up with any kind of hook connection with the reader. And for a book that's going to be, for the most part, entirely about aliens, this is an issue. This is a bit of a problem. So you have to have something to tie back to the reader. And part, since the reader is human, you have to have a human thing that the alien has. And with Greedock the Splithead, with his petty puffs and his upright stance and his one large eye, and I did find the cheat sheet for eye color on the Siglopedia under Quith. So I've got that taken care of. The challenge has been for me to find a way to talk about what growing up as a Quith leader might have been like. Now, I have carte blanche. I can have him growing up in the mean streets. I can have him growing up any way I want. And in many ways, that's kind of a problem because there's so many choices. So it goes back to basic fundamental motivations. And his motivations need to be human. That's the problem. It's like, what human motivations could a Quith leader have? And it came to me in a conversation I was having with J. Daniel Sawyer the other night. What exactly the crux of his problem is. And so the challenge is to figure out, what does he want? And I know what he wants. And what are the obstacles? Who are the people or beings or entities putting the obstacles in his way? Because those are that's the antagonist. I really only have time for one antagonist. And I don't know who the antagonist is yet. I know who the opponent will be ultimately. And that's this key leader of the syndicate, whom Greedock must depose. But how does he get the name Splithead? And as a side bonus, how does Masal get the name Efficient? I don't really need to explain Vyrak the Mean or Chodo the Bright. I don't need to explain any of those people. But I do need to explain Splithead. And I think I got it. I think I've got it. So, what I need now is fingers on keys. Butt and chair. Well, but not in chair, but fingers on keys on the stand-up desk, I think. I need to get this thing pounded, because that's the only way it's going to get done now, is if I dig in and start pounding away. So I've got a couple of things I've got to deal with today. Where first is that I still have a sick kid, and apparently the antibiotic they gave her reacted badly with her system, and she's having some issues. She's home again today, and on the mend. She actually got up and volunteered to have breakfast this morning, which is a good sign. She will have to go to school tomorrow. She won't be able to go to the prom on Friday. It's a school rule. She says she feels better, but she's still a little weak, and her muscles are a little... She says her muscles are swollen. I think she means her hands are swollen from the water buildup. So we're trying to find out. I don't know if we're supposed to take her back to the doctor today. If we do, that'll be a big chunk out of the middle of the day. I'm at the troublesome chop sign, the trickiest intersection of the walk, and of course there's a car, but he was well back before I started across the street, so I trusted that he would stop, and he did, so I didn't get hit. Some morning I may be walking along and you'll hear me get hit by a car. That would be amusing. If that happens, I'll make sure I get it posted. But it's a lovely morning this morning. It's above freezing. There's a little bit of water on the edges. It's like 35 degrees. I'm still wearing my fleece hood. And I'm really quite heavily bundled. Probably too bundled for the weather. But I knew I was coming out early. And it was going to be sun not quite up yet. The morning picture today, by the way, was, I thought, I have to wait to see what it looks like on Flickr, but it looked terrific. I don't usually, you know, I take these pictures and I go, yeah, another picture of the field and the tree, but the sun this morning was behind that cloud, and there's a sort of sepia tint to it, at least in the screen on the camera, so perhaps it's as striking as it looks. Perhaps not. So there's another post today on the Shatskin Files. I didn't get a chance to read it this morning before I left the house. But it's another post about atomization and how content creators are going to go vertical with publication. Publishing won't go away, but the industry itself may well be subsumed. Which, coming from Shatskin, is quite a statement. I'm turning east on the Great Eastern Reach now. Sun is sort of pearlescent behind the clouds up there. There's patches of blue sky, but there's a lot of clouds up there today. I think that's what helped keep the temperature a little warmer overnight. There wasn't a lot of radiant energy escaping. So, yeah, Shatskin has some posts. I was also engaged in a conversation with Laura Gibbs about adjunct faculty. Monk Paul. And apparently the Chronicle of Higher Education had an article quite critical of the business model that many universities are falling into, in that they're hiring non-tenure track adjunct faculty, not paying them benefits, not offering them tenure, not giving them anything like a retirement plan, just treating them as like temporary labor. And when the temporary labor outnumbers the actual labor, that becomes a business model. And the problem with it is that it really undercuts the value of the university. And I think the article was making the point that in a certain sense it's a bit unethical. I'm not sure it's unethical. I'm not 100% convinced, because even not-for-profits, even educational institutions that are not-for-profit, that are state schools, that are private not-for-profit educational institutions, I'm not sure that they don't have some ethical requirement to maintain themselves in the face of increasing animosity, increasing restrictions in cash flows that are no longer coming from state and, to a certain extent, federal government. The reality of the research landscape these days, or at least when I left a couple of years ago, if you weren't one of the big research institutions, if you weren't Duke, if you weren't Berkeley, if you weren't the Jet Propulsion Lab, if you weren't MIT, you weren't, in terms of viability for research dollars. Even some really big programs. There was a big deafness program at Kent State, which should have been funded, and I don't believe it was. Our modest effort to create better understanding for the blindness and visual impairment community, for the teachers of people with blindness and visual impairment, and other significant support needs, that was a very small, by the way they measure these things, that was a ridiculously tiny stipend that they were offering us. It was barely enough to keep doors open, and yet we managed to, in a very real sense, we managed to really change the world. We managed to raise the awareness of these low incidence disabilities, the ones that occur in less than 0.25% of the population of school-aged children, and yet because they're so rare but so debilitating, they require special and significant levels of support in order to offer those children the opportunities to succeed in life, not just in school, but in life. So with research dollars drying up, with the funding, the basic funding, I can't even tell you how many hundreds of millions of dollars the state has cut UNC's budget by. But it's staggering. I know 1 year it was $82 million was the cut. You can't take an institution like UNC and cut 30%, 40% without expecting things to happen. I remember when School of Mines, which is one of the big schools over in Boulder, it's a very prestigious, very expensive school to go to begin with. But School of Mines is one of the few schools that offer degrees in mining engineering, apparently. And what better place than in the Rockies? And the state cut their funding by some huge, drastic amount. It was one of the few, because of the Taxpayer's Bill of Rights, the Tabor Amendment to the Colorado Constitution, which basically takes fiscal control out of the hands of the legislature and puts it in an automated funding scheme where you have only a limited amount of discretionary funds, and everything else has to be spent in designated ways on prescribed percentages, which is a terrible, terrible way to run any institution, let alone state government, because the state government really does need to be free to respond to environmental factors, and at the moment they are prohibited from reacting to environmental issues by the state constitution. It's literally illegal for them to do their job. So I can understand their frustration in a certain sense. One of the few discretionary funds they have is higher education. And so when they need money, that's the one that they have to cut. And they have to cut it a lot because of the retrenchment of the economy here. So anyway, one of the stipulations of the state charters is that as long as the legislature pays 10% of the operating cost of the institution has some rules and regulations about what they can charge state residents for tuition and how they can structure their fees and tuition payments. And in the second round of cuts, I think it was the second year they did the cuts, they trimmed Boulder below the 10% mark. School of Mines fell below 10% of their revenue. And so they were free to change their fee structures, and they did. They changed fee structures. They started charging more for more popular courses. So the courses that had big enrollments started paying better. Courses that had small enrollments got cut. Fees went up. And the state legislature went bullshit. They said, oh, hey, you can't do that. You're a state institution. And the chancellor went to the Board of Regents and said, according to our charter, we have not only the right, but we have an obligation to, because you've not funded us. And since you've not funded us, you no longer have any say over what we do financially. And the legislature had to drop back. They've now been maintaining a very careful 11% control of all of the rest of the institutions. The School of Mines is still kind of out there. I think there's a couple others. There's a Colorado State and Colorado University Boulder, CU Boulder. They still have some latitude. But they also, CU Boulder has a big medical center that has a lot of research dollars that come to it. So while they're hurting, it's nothing like we are here, the Colorado Normal School. Yeah, 18 minutes for the second mile. But in the face of this being the school of education for the state, the problem is that a lot of the other schools have started eating away at it by offering programs. For example, in order to teach without a special provisional license, you have to take courses from Fort Collins, and you have to take them resident. There's another place where you have to take courses resident. I think it's in the south part of the state. I forget what it is now. I stopped looking into it because it just wasn't worth it. Oh, I know what it was. It was the fast track for classroom teacher. There's a fast track career change pass for people who want to become classroom teachers. But in order to do that, you have to go to Durango and live for a year in order to take the courses. And it's like, yeah, that's going to happen. Not at all. So anyway, but 18 minutes on the second mile, which means I must be at the back gate, and I am. And it's the point where I say tomorrow is another day. And with any luck at all, I'll talk to you then.